This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 33. I'm delighted to be joined by John Siegel, partner in the fintech practice at City Lawyers Fox Williams. Tech debt is a well-known phenomenon in the startup VC world. In essence, this means that you start your business with a spreadsheet, then you need to upgrade it to an Access database, and then SQL database, etc., etc., etc. The main point being that when the business is on a fast growth curve, you're always in catch-up mode with the tech. In a recent article for Altify, I extended the concept to risk debt. You do what you have to do, but in the exponential growth phase from startup to scale up to mature company, you're once again always playing catch up. One of the categories of risk debt that is so important it deserves a show on its own is legal debt. Once again, you start with some simple documents you downloaded from the internet and carry on. Once again, you're playing catch up. Once again, you're playing with fire, hoping you don't fall through the tech risk legal holes. John's a well-known figure on the London fintech scene and has plenty of practical experience with the new FS firms that are growing fast and managing this problem at the coalface. He recently chaired an interesting Fox Williams seminar on risk in the alternative finance space. In a new sector, a rarity in itself, one never knows how good a legal structure or document is until it's tested in court. Before then, it's just a bunch of words and some fees. So, for example, how well will platforms hand over their agency responsibilities in the case of a platform failure? How can we have solid risk and legal controls without stifling innovation? Will it be left to a workout crew from the Big Four to plough through a pile of legal agreements, undocumented passwords, etc., desperately trying to de-anonymize contracts between the P and the P and P to P? Will it be a tangle of spaghetti so bad like Shearson Lehman's, which was so stressful for the regulators that they've introduced a provision and structures that all derivatives need to be centrally cleared thereafter? There are many, many, many such untested cases. These are the sharp end of legal debt. Anyway, once again, what do I know? So far better to dive into kicking it around with someone who does. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, John. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm glad you're addressing the issues of legal risk, or legal debt, as you call it. Being a lawyer who's worked through the good times and the bad times, it's obviously a topic very close to my heart.
That reminds me of that song by, is it Fatboy Slim? I have to celebrate you, baby, for hard times and the good. I'm actually very glad that you're here, John, because I'm certainly not going to talk about this topic whatsoever. I'll just prod you with my stick through the bars and get you to talk about it. Now, we all start these things with a little conversation about how you're a human being, but once again, I've got a lawyer on the show, and we all know that lawyers don't have time to be a human being, as they're always working so hard 25 hours a day. But you were just telling me that you used to be a human being when you were younger and you were thinking of becoming one again.
At uni, I must say, I always had aspirations of being a human rights lawyer, you know, saving the world, being a defender of the people. And then there you are, you arrive day one in your city law firm, day one of your training contract, and that does get royally beaten out of you. And then, yeah, all those aspirations move on, you know, have kids, have family, etc., etc. But actually, a few years ago, when I started looking into the fintech space, I actually saw an opportunity to give a little back. You know, the application of technology to finance is really, I guess, helping to redeem my soul. We're designing legal structures to actually democratize finance. You know, there's no Marxist agenda here, but in a world where the consumer's actually happy and protected, and you know, the business serving that customer is also happy, then everyone's a winner. The business is making money, and the consumer is also saving money and being protected.
Yes, it's interesting. You hang out on the scene, as do I, and I'm no longer surprised, but I used to be surprised quite a while, that the motivation of a lot of people really is, to create a better financial services system that won't blow up the world when our kids are at the age that we all were in 2008 and have to bail it out again. And in terms of doing good for the world, again, that may seem a bit strange to some folks, but as we're recording this, I'm releasing the previous podcast, which is with World Remit, who are busy saving the poorest people in the world tenfold sum of money on their currency exchanges. So actually, the sector is doing a lot of good at the good end of it. And in terms of your sort of twin career of being a lawyer, but also in fintech. Your Twitter handle is Fintech Guru. So does this mean you know everything about fintech?
I wouldn't say I know everything about fintech, but you know, I've worked in finance, banking finance for about 12, 13 years now. worked in the big banks and the financial institutions, both pre and post-crisis. So I think I'm very well-versed in how a lot of financial products work, how they should work, how sometimes they don't work quite as well as they should do.
So you've seen it from the being an outhouse lawyer and in-house lawyer then. Were you seconded there, or did you sort of give up being a solicitor and go into a bank and come out again?
Both, actually. So when I was a few years qualified, I sort of knew it all, went in-house to a company called Citco, where we were lending funds to hedge funds, which probably seemed like a good idea in about 2006. Then actually left the law for a little bit, went travelling for a year, saw the world.
All right, where did you go?
Southeast Asia, China, a bit of South America as well. Had a great time, came back, bit of soul searching.
I came back, bit of soul searching, and you looked at your credit card bills.
Yeah, I realised that actually I quite enjoyed being a lawyer, and so went back into it. Then after a few years, went to join one of the big banks on secondment. And it was really there that kind of developed a passion for fintech, because I was, you know, working in this big bank, floors of people, querying actually what they all did. And, you know, actually sometimes the legal team could perhaps be seen as a barrier to doing business as opposed to helping to do business. And very much my focus has been trying to help businesses and people through legal problems rather than being an obstacle.
Yes, you're the kind of in-house lawyer that I always liked when I was inside banks, one who thinks he's there to help as opposed to one who thinks he's there to document and slow the world down. And it's interesting, there are a few people in fintech, not as many as you might think, but there are quite a few people in fintech who have worked inside banks, which is interesting in that, on the one hand, it gives them a clear understanding of FS, which is chiefly around in FS, you need to get all the details right. You can't hand wave in the way that you can with some other tech. And that's a lesson that's never forgotten. And at the same time, it gives them an insight into all the difficulties that the old financial services institutions have, which are really the difficulties that, on the other hand, from a business perspective, the new financial services companies or the fintechs are taking advantage of. So I think it's really useful to understand both sides of the equation.
Exactly. I mean, quite a lot of people come to me with a grand new idea, very exciting, it's going to be completely disruptive to the industry, and quite often it is. But when we kind of sit down and map it out, strip back the layers, what you have underneath it is a product that's been used for hundreds of years in some cases, especially in the insurance world, and is really taking those basics, the old FS principles, and applying the technology layer over it and the customer experience, and trying to come up with a solution that works both from a legal and a regulatory and a business perspective.
Yes, which is where the interest lies for those of you who haven't worked in the sector, because it is a sort of multi-dimensional equation. So moving on to my poorly named, perhaps, phrase of legal debt, because that rather makes one wonder what illegal debt might be. But I'm really just talking about this phenomenon that businesses grow, and especially when they're growing as some of the alternative finance, and particularly the P2P platforms, are growing very rapidly. The equity platforms aren't growing so rapidly for reasons to do with the fact they're not really building up a portfolio which provides a rental income. I'm digressing here, but equity crowdfunding people really need deal fees. So today's deal fees pay for the rent today and a bit of profit. But if you don't have any deals tomorrow, you don't have anything going. Whereas if you're a P2P, you can have a sort of $1 billion portfolio there, which is paying you money every day of the week, even if you're not doing some. So how do you see this thing called legal debt or legal catch-up or whatever, and what should I call it? And please don't say it doesn't exist, otherwise I've got nothing to talk about for the rest of the show.
It certainly does exist. And actually, I think you're talking about legal debt. I think we also probably stray into, you know, regulatory debt, if there is such a thing. I mean, let's just think about how we, you know, how I approach a client, as I said, to get these clients come in. Totally disruptive idea. How do we get it to market? And they have lots of ideas, but there's obviously a legal framework that needs to be designed. So it really is just sitting down in a room, piece of A3 and some coloured pens, and doing some diagrams and just seeing what actually is this product, how does it work, and are there any legal issues? And almost certainly there are. It's then a matter of then taking kind of the legal structure that we've come up with and actually taking it to our regulatory team as well to see if there's any regulatory issues. And again, quite often, this being, you know, financial services, there are regulatory issues.
Yes, it's an interesting question, the whole regulation thing. The fluffy bunny propaganda about regulation, like using the phrase light touch regulation. But I was talking to the chief executive of P2P recently, who was telling me he had a team in from one of the big four for several months just to get them regulated. And this is a business which fits in a large room. So how light touch it is a matter of perspective. You know, if you're an HSBC or a Citigroup, you will consider it extremely light touch. If you're from any other bloody industry in the entire world, you will consider it extremely onerous to spend months and months with a big four team sitting in your office purely to get some boxes ticked and the approval. So coming back to where this legal debt slash risk catch-up-y thing all comes from. I think in the introduction, I was really pointing in two directions. The first, which is the whole scale-up process, which is the analogy with tech debt. But the second dimension is the fact that this stuff has never been done before. There haven't been peer-to-peers, so there haven't been peer-to-peers blowing up. I mean, we all know what it looks like when a bank blows up, because there's been lots of precedents for that. So there are these two different dimensions, and maybe you want to talk about one or t'other in terms of how the legal stuff works as you're scaling up, or the challenge of something that's never been done before.
Let's start with the scale-up side of things. I mean, I guess you're asking, does legal risk increase or potentially decrease as you scale up?
Yeah, is there a lag as well? Is everybody always in kind of catch-up mode? I mean, I know that officially no one is, but in practice, when you're managing an organisation, you know, you're always trying to sort of pull one part of the organisation back up to the curve or another.
Yeah, well, actually, I think I see two types of clients that come in, and I think the ones that have potentially come from the old FS do want, you know, the complete legal and regulatory service and don't want to move outside of those areas. Whereas you get other clients who maybe don't come from that background, want to push on, and the legal and regulatory is second. I mean, obviously, being a lawyer, I'd say that the prudent thing to do is to really map out that legal and regulatory framework first before going any further, because you could find a little bit further down the line that you get tripped up and the FCA is kind of knocking on the door. But arguably, I think the main legal risks are in actually starting up. You know, there are lots of legal and regulatory issues to grapple with, and quite a lot of the things we're doing, and indeed other law firms are doing at the moment, is, you know, pushing the law and regulation to the limit, especially while in the startup and scale-up phase. There's quite a lot of, you know, square pegs trying to fit in round holes. You know, the FCA has been actually fantastic in introducing regulation, particularly around peer-to-peer lending and crowdfunding, but they were and are designed around the incumbents. And so when people are coming to me trying to set up new platforms, they realise that just to say, let's set up a carbon copy of X, isn't necessarily going to cut the mustard.
Basically, there's a new square peg. There's the old square peg and the new square peg. And if you come up with a triangular one, it doesn't really fit into either the old or the old.
Yes, and I can't give you particular examples due to client confidentiality, but essentially that little tweak of the business model, yeah, which is going to make them hopefully a challenger in that space in one way or another, really does throw up lots of surprising issues that they perhaps hadn't thought of.
Yes, and the sad thing for me, from a risk perspective, is how the primary focus has become regulation, understandably so, because in effect, regulation's a kind of law and they'll put you in the Tower of London if you don't follow it, so it would be, wouldn't it? But regulators, of course, themselves, they're always playing a catch-up game. They're always regulating for the last disaster. A good example, as I mentioned in the beginning, is all this regulation around derivatives clearing. That's still working through the system, you know, years afterwards. So it's interesting, as you say, that there's this kind of bifurcation between the people who are pressing on, and I can think of good examples of one type and the other in the equity crowdfunding market. People are more marketing-driven, press on, want to do all the business and don't want to get hamstrung. In the worst case, you've got the likes of Uber with tens of billions of dollars and they just sort of bang on regardless of the rules, regulations, laws in any country. That's an extreme case, but you do see versions of that. And I'm interested in your comment that people who do come from FS know that, look, we need to start by dotting the I and crossing the D. If we want a building, we want a nice sort of concrete foundation to build it on.
Exactly, exactly. And actually, there is precedent here. I mean, just look at the banks and, you know, without wishing to point out any in particular, but you look at, you know, Barclays Investment Bank 10, 12 years ago came from nowhere to be really one of the leading investment banks in the world. And, you know, all the I's weren't dotted, all the T's weren't crossed, and kind of look where it is now. Lots of issues and the regulator crawling on over it. And, you know, Barclays is not alone in this case.
Yes, I'm not sure how much the Barclays was legal as such. I mean, I'm sure you know more than I, but a chap who worked for me went there to be the head of risk in the investment bank, so I heard lots of the inside track stories for quite some time. My understanding is that it was really that sort of Bob Diamond was very much a growth market CEO who liked taking lots of risk and kept doubling and kept doubling and kept doubling. And that, you know, that approach, as we all know, is guaranteed to win in a casino until you run out of money to gamble. If every time you lose in a casino, you double your next bet, you will definitely be ahead of the game at some point in time. You just may have required $1 trillion if you got off to a bad start. So anyway, that's just a tangent, but I do take the point. So without mixing my metaphors, either that or trying to be too clever for my own good. So we start our scale up with a nice concrete platform, but then one day the nuclear power station melts down and melts through the concrete platform. And we've then got a situation where we are in uncharted territory. And as I said before, I think that's something that people don't necessarily understand as much as they might about the nature of the law. And please feel free to disagree with me because I don't know anything about what I'm talking about as usual. But, you know, everybody has to hire lawyers and everyone gets documents and all that. That's just fine, though. But then that's just words on a sheet of paper. You know, that's Arial font 12 or Times New Roman or whatever. And actually, when the shicer hits the fan, is in a court. Well, there's another lawyer saying that your Arial font 12 or your Times New Roman font 13 doesn't actually work, and his does. And, you know, then sort of the dogs have got their teeth in, and a judge has to try and sort of untangle it all. I mean, Shearson's been quite a good example. So what would you say around all this kind of issue that, you know, the meltdown and also the nature of what a legal document is and a legal structure in a company in the first place?
Just to pick up on your point, you know.
To pick on my point or pick up on my point?
Pick up on your
point. Oh, no, to pick on it, that's much more fun.
Then I just pick on you, Mike. You know, Lehman Brothers is a classic example. It's still being litigated over. I mean, some of the cases only were recently settled. And that's an example of where the underlying legal structure was simply far too complicated and too difficult to unwind. But, you know, let's take a look at a typical peer-to-peer platform. Not all platforms are the same, but, you know, they use quite a lot of the same legal principles behind them. In theory, where you've got, you know, a lender and a borrower being matched up by the platform, you know, the lender should be taking no counterparty risk on the peer-to-peer platform itself because there is a nice, solid legal contract between the lender and the borrower. That's really the underpinning of this peer-to-peer process.
Yes. Can I just press pause on that? Because I'm really interested in this, but I've always been interested in this, how legally the anonymization works. So I put my money in Funding Circle. I know I've lent it to, I don't know, ICI or a smaller version of ICI. If I put it into a Zopa or a rate setter, I don't know that I've lent John Siegel, a lawyer who's got huge gambling debts or something on the other side of it, because it's anonymised. Now, when I was married, which had a contract, it had my name on and my then wife's name on, which I found quite useful when it came to divorce, because I knew how I was divorcing. So I always assumed that a legal document started saying, this is a legal document between John and Mike. So how does it work when this is a legal document between John and we're not quite sure who?
Well, actually, very interestingly, you know, quite often the legal concept of agency is used. So the platform is the agent of the lenders, right, and those lenders are not disclosed to the borrower and vice versa. Although, as you say, in the Funding Circle example, the borrower has actually disclosed, but in the consumer credit rate set as Zopa, then it's not disclosed. So, you know, an agency is a typical legal method that's used every day in commerce. So there's no reason why it can't be used here.
So my contract would be, for example, with rate setter. As an agent?
As an agent of the lenders, yes.
Right. OK, well, we'll come back to that, because when the platform melts down, as I was saying earlier,
yes,
how easy it is to then sort of de-anonymise is an interesting question. But anyway, returning to your point.
Yes, I mean, there are a number of protections. The lender obviously has a legal right directly against the borrower. I think where you're going with this is, well, they don't know who each other are.
When the shit's hit the fan.
You can't go and serve a writ saying you owe me some money.
Exactly, the nuclear power station's melted down and all this kind of stuff. Who the fuck do I sue?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, people have spotted this, the Peer-to-Peer Finance Association and the FCA have realised that, you know, as you say, if the proverbial does hit the fan, then you've got a bit of a dog's dinner, a bit of a mess to sort out. So there are certain things that are required now by the FCA and that you need to put in place. Basically, you need a plan. And it needs to be a funded plan as well.
The living will kind of thing.
Exactly. So it's kind of living will light. So all the banks now have to have a wind down process, yeah, that isn't going to take 6 years of legal wrangling to sort out a la Lehman's.
In theory.
There was
that Austrian general, whoever it was, that said it's, you know, very important to plan, but no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Correct. So you've got these plans in place. And I think both the lenders and the borrowers on the platform can take some comfort. You know, the question is, if you were a lender, I don't think you're really going to do your due diligence on those contracts and to see whether there is really money in place. I think you're relying on the fact that this is an FCA authorised business and the FCA is doing their job and checking and doing that due diligence. And as you said, take comfort from the fact that big four accountants have been in there crawling all over the paperwork and ensuring that it works.
Ensuring that, again, but coming back to the lack of precedent, ensuring that it works in principle.
Correct.
In practice, as I mentioned before on the podcast, I was at Landsbanking when it blew up. In practice, when the, as you call it more politely than I, the proverbial hits the fan, life tends not to go according to plan because everyone's worried about paying their mortgages and panicking and, you know, everyone's running all over the darn place. So the, in practice, wind down of a complete bloody mess is always, it's always like a battle. It's, you know, arms and legs are being chopped off left, right and centre.
Yeah, I think as a lender on a platform, I think you have to realise that if the platform does meltdown. You're not going to be able to get your money out straight away.
There is going to be a hiccup. Landsbanki being a good example, that everybody in the UK got their money back eventually. But it was eventually, and it was tied up for quite a little while sort of, you know, people at PricewaterhouseCoopers were paid $5,000 a day to go through the files or whatever the metaphorical equivalent was.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, I'd say there'd be at least 3 months, could potentially be a year, could potentially even be more. But, you know, depends on the circumstances.
So the way I see that, going back to your agency word, is very, very relevant in the context, which is that I see it that if you're lending money through a peer-to-peer platform, you've got agency risk on the platform. You shouldn't have principal risk going through the platform. I'm a little bit wary that sometimes principal risk can creep in a little bit, but you've always got agency risk in the same way that if you've got a holiday flat in Portugal and you've got a local agent managing it for you, and the managing agent falls over, you haven't lost your apartment in Portugal, but if the washing machine started leaking, you've got challenges, which because nobody's actually managing that for you. Or equivalently speaking, if someone stops paying interest on a loan, there's nobody chasing it up for you, servicing it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's the same with any kind of investment that you make, any kind of high street investment. Unless you're a property landlord and you're managing that yourself, you've always got an agency risk. If you're putting money into a fund, you've got a risk on the fund that they're doing it. So I don't really see any difference here.
Oh, right. That's a good challenge then. So I've got to spot where the difference. Well, so I'm planning a holiday at the moment, and as usual, I go to Expedia, and I got something from them saying, here's our ABTA certificate. As we all know, because the travel agency business has seen failures in the past, they now have a scheme which is their equivalent to the financial services compensation scheme, that if you go through one of their member organisations, they will sort you out. So that's their approach to it. I don't know how it works with holiday flats in Portugal because I don't have them, but there's all these things like, you know, the British Real Estate Association, etc., etc. And I think I would say that because these kind of organisations have been around for longer and they've seen failures in their industry, that actually one can have a higher degree of confidence. It's going to be easier for them to sort out a failure of Expedia or something without it sort of hitting the fan for too long, in the same way that, you know, that all the regulators are on the case about banks failing. And I just rather suspect that it won't be that way in P2P until we've had a few high-profile failures, been through all these mechanisms, and then all the regulation, the legal documents are fine-tuned a bit and a few more paragraphs have been added here and there.
Yeah, well, I guess going to draw a distinction that, you know...
That's what lawyers do very well, is draw distinctions, actually. Let's draw a distinction.
My lord, this is a very different case before us. The example you gave, a holiday is a holiday. The product doesn't really change, but looking at peer-to-peer, I think the products do change. I mean, you know, from a lender's perspective, what is the peer-to-peer product? You know, you've not only got the consumer loans product, you've got the SME loans product, we've now got receivables financing product, we've got real estate product, both on the equity and the debt. I mean, and actually, you know, I can say that we're working on new products as well here at Fox Williams. So there's lots of different products, and I don't think there'd be a one-size-fits-all fund for everything.
I absolutely agree. It's becoming a very heterogeneous industry, and P2P is becoming less and less meaningful. And if I was a lawyer on the other side of the table, I would just actually use what you've said to strengthen my case, in which is that it just makes it far more complicated. So you've got all these subsectors, which actually are rather different. I mean, you know, invoice financing is different from consumer debt,
absolutely,
is different from SME and secured and unsecured and all this kind of stuff, which probably makes the lenders just wish they'd cross their fingers. So what other issues do you think are arising around the meltdown scenario?
Yeah, I mean, is there a mechanism in place to sort things out when things go wrong? Well, I think the first thing to point out is that, you know, there is no central fund for people to rely on. None of the platforms are covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. And so as a lender, what you're really relying on is what's known as the Provision Fund or Protection Fund, which actually is not really a fund at all.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm always interested, actually. So as people know, one or two or three or four platforms have a provision fund, as they call it. The other ones are more marketplace lending, like Funding Circle, who just pass it through. And I've always been rather concerned myself around provision funds, largely because banks have had provision funds for centuries. It hasn't stopped them going bust. You know, it works for quite a while until it doesn't work, like many things, firstly. And then secondly, I've always been concerned, and this seems to me a good example of legal debt, by the fact that if actually you try and drill into it, you know, you find that some are trusts and some are companies and some have got common directors, and I haven't yet seen an investment policy for any of them. So, you know, what is the money in the provision fund invested in? And it's a self-insurance policy, and if you're doing that in insurance, you need actuaries to come in and validate your assumptions and that, rather than you say, oh, I think this is enough. I think we're 152% covered and all that kind of thing. So from a lawyer's perspective, how do you see this whole provision fund area? And is it something that might need tightening up as time goes by?
Interesting question. And I think each provision fund is different. It's structured in a different way, whether that's legally and or commercially. And so I think, yeah, going back to what we said before, each product is different, so there's no one size fits all. So I think it is something that if you're a lender, it's worth drilling into a little bit more to see whether there would be sufficient funds to pay out in the event of any issues.
And equally that, you know, in terms of test of destruction, what you're talking about is really a sort of kind of a Darwinian evolution stage at the moment, that there are many, quote, competing models out there for how to do this right. So if in some quantum universe we cloned the entire B2B sector many times and the entire universe for this purpose many times, we might find out that, let's say, there's five different models. We might find out that models A and B are actually fairly robust through a huge mega crisis. But whatever you do, don't do model D and E, because that's just a complete nightmare. And this is the kind of thing that all industries go through as they mature. You know, travel engines being quite a good one. It's so mature now that they know how to cope with disasters and what happens when people are stranded abroad and, you know, all the things that you never expect. I mean, you can't expect the unexpected.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure the regulator will have a view on this if, when the first big blow-up of a platform happens. You know.
I'm glad you have faith in the regulators. I've been around too many decades, and the regulator tends to be better when the sort of the stable door was being bolted after the horse has gone, but we live in hope. So what are your concluding thoughts on this then, John, in terms of pulling this all together? And, you know, we've picked up sort of different areas around the whole thing. I liked your idea that, you know, my phrase, not yours, that more marketing-driven organisations tend to focus on pressing on and catching up everything else later. Some of the more sort of belt and braces-y background people start with this sort of stuff. So it's not the same across the industry. And also your point is very well made that there are many models out there. So again, you can't generalise. And I think we're both agreed that the profile changes as the company goes through time, and we're going to see what works and doesn't work when we get into the courts and all that kind of thing. And at this stage, it's probably sounding so confusing to the listener. What's your takeaway rather than my takeaway?
Yeah, my takeaway would be
hire a good lawyer, presumably.
Hire a good lawyer, of course.
It's very good. Yeah,
I know
good.
One or two.
Boom.
And I think it's, you know, really put in the time, the effort, and, you know, there is a cost to this of really mapping out all the legal issues that you can think of on day one and the regulatory issues, drawing detailed structure plans, structure charts, and then mapping that against the regulatory framework. Once you've got that, then you can work out where you can push the envelopes, push the boundaries, or you may decide that actually it's not worth pushing some of those boundaries. You know, I think as long as you impose adequate systems and controls without stifling innovation, then you've got a good chance of succeeding. You know, the computer says no attitude really isn't going to work in this fintech industry. I'd also say, in this type of industry, if you've got to ask the legal team, you know, whether you can actually push the envelope on this area, you should probably know the answer already.
Absolutely. And I think listening to you talk about that, it reminds me that to do all of what you say, and I'm totally subscribed to everything you say, relies on internal structures. And I've been writing again, probably whistling into the wind here, but trying to remind people of what the world was like 20 plus years ago when CROs, chief risk officers, were poachers turned gamekeepers, and the role was much more trying to make sure that the chairman can sleep at 4 o'clock in the morning by considering everything that might go wrong. In the P2P industry at the moment, we've got people who are called CROs, and they really focus on, for example, credit or regulation. Very, 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 very necessary. Very, very, very necessary, but not sufficient. Because really, I'd like to see CROs in P2P's job being, what could possibly go wrong in this firm? And not just at the operational level, but also at the non-executive level. So chums of mine are non-executives on building societies and that kind of thing. And you've got a non-executive chairing the risk committee. And they're allowed to sit there and say, OK, CRO, so what are you doing about legal risk then? You know, and set in chain projects there. So I think, again, structurally, I think, you know, as old FS and new FS, as each side takes the better parts from the other, I'd like to see the P2Ps going more along that line, having a non-executive on the board who's in charge of risk and who can say things like, OK, so tell me about the legal risk then. You know, what are the legal risks out there? Where could we be tightening it up? It's this kind of continuous improvement process that the Japanese have in manufacturing, you know, the same kind of thing. And maybe when this current growth phase, the dash for growth that we're seeing in so many firms, subsides a little bit, people can start focusing on quality. Really, we're talking about quality issues here. So moving on to, as you say, you can recommend a good lawyer. Well, maybe you might start by recommending Fox Williams. So for people who don't know Fox Williams practice that well or at all, John, so tell us a little bit about what Fox Williams is and where it fits into the firmament.
We're a UK-based law firm based in the City of London, really in between Tech City, the kind of Old Street Silicon Roundabout area, and the traditional city. And we're focused on certain sectors, and it probably comes as no surprise that two of those are financial services and technology. And when you meld those two together, you come out with fintech. And that's where I come in. I kind of spearhead the fintech team here. But really, it's not just about me. My background's very much in financial services, banking and finance, lots of debt products, essentially, debt and equity products. But it's not just the skill sets that I have that are needed to build a successful fintech practice. We've also got the regulatory angle. We have a very good regulatory team here. We have the technology team here as well. I mean, data protection is a huge area, which actually is an issue for a lot of fintech companies. And really, we're actually unusual, I guess, in that we actually all talk to each other. The technology lawyers speak to the finance lawyers, who speak to the regulatory lawyers.
And that's the benefit of scale. I mean, you know, you aren't a firm with thousands of people and warring tribes. You know, even if you're all sort of grumbling at each other, you're actually all sort of sitting in fairly sort of small space, relatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, you know, our focus is very much on those sectors, the financial services, technology, fintech being one of those big areas. And, you know, really looking to be the go-to firm for both old FS firms looking to embrace the fintech revolution, embrace the technology side, and really the tech-focused firms that really want, you know, a good city-based law firm as well, who understand the principles of financial regulation and the products as well. So that's really where we're headed.
I was talking to a big cheese, you remain nameless, yesterday in the fintech firmament, and like yourself and like myself, he has a lot of experience in old FS and the new FS, as I like to call it. And I think that, going back to where we started, I think that one finds that people who've worked in both sides can see the advantages of both sides. Not everything about existing financial services is wrong. There's a lot of strength, there's a lot of understanding of what financial services is. And equally, not everything in the new FS is currently right either. At the same time, there's lots of sexy, new, appealing, value-added stuff that's actually helping the world in new FS, and the old FS is a bit tardy and arguably a little bit more sort of greedy in terms of trying to make money out of its clients and rather forgetting that by and large it should be there to serve them. So I think there are positives on both sides, and I can certainly see that a firm like yours that can pull together these various silos in a more united fashion and understands the pros and cons on both sides can be a really important bridge between the old world and the new world. And the central thing on the London FinTech Podcast logo is Tower Bridge, and that metaphor is meant to indicate that actually the future lies in the middle of the bridge. It doesn't lie with the old, it doesn't lie with the new, it lies with where we're going to, which is a combination of the two.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel very privileged to be working on the one hand with startups, as I said, some who have come out of old FS, some who are very much on the tech side, and then also working with the existing financial institutions and just really seeing both sides and using experiences from both to both sets of clients. And that's a real privilege for me.
And in terms of the overall topic here about the legal risks in peer-to-peer lending or alternative finance as a whole or fintech, then whilst there are lots of, you know, bitty stuff we've spoken about, I think, you know, you and I have come from financial services from a very different perspective, but we're both agreed that it is very worthwhile getting all this stuff as sorted as it can possibly be and cover all the scenarios well ahead of time, because along with regulation and dotting I's and crossing T's, that's what you really need to do the financial services. You don't want to be sort of out there on a limb, desperately trying to sort of strengthen the roots of the tree, as it were, if I'm not going with a funny metaphor. So I definitely recommend that anybody who's active in fintech at the moment consider their firms legal risks and consider whether they've got all the scenarios covered, or consider whether they need a project to review what they're doing and seeing where it can be tightened up. So thanks for being on the show today, John, and good luck in that future.
Thanks, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey. Mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance with me.